lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Ken, welcome back to the Politics Guys.
It is good to be back.
So every, you know, we're coming back a little bit sooner to give Mike and Jay a break, but you're doing it from remote locations on both goes. You know, we had talked a few weeks ago about maybe your title. I wonder if we don't need to get persistent, or I don't know, something about having the grit when the other two hosts can't do it. We really always can.
Yeah, they're not doing it because they're traveling, but I'm traveling and I'm doing it anyhow.
Exactly. So I mean, so we got Jay, the defender of freedom. I just feel like I'm still working on that effectively. So I'm just throwing that back out there.
Yeah.
For those of you on, the relentless Ken relentless cat Ken. I don't know. That could work. Well, we got a bunch of fun show items coming up today. So let me just run you through what we're going to be getting to in our format. And this is going to be for everyone. We're going to be talking about the Kansas vote on Roe v. Wade. There's a lot of data to dive into that. We're going to talk about that. Then we'll move on. That's going to transition to us chatting about the rest of the primaries this past week, what that might tell us about the midterms, and if there's any silver linings for Democrats, or if it's just all, you know, smoke and mirrors for them. We're going to move forward and talk a little bit about the bipartisan U.S. senators who are attempting to codify Roe and the unlikely possibilities of that, but why that might be moving forward. We'll also talk, and we're going to get into some detail, about Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, which I think is a historic moment as we kind of think about a lot of oxygen has been taken up with Russia, rightfully so, but we'll be talking about what's happening with China. And then from there, we'll be moving right back to the Russian question as the Senate adds Sweden and Finland to NATO in a vote. Of course, there's more to go down there, so we'll talk about that. And we've got a few other stories if we have time. So we're going to take just a moment. We're going to pause right here, and we'll be back chatting about Roe v. Wade. Ken, so this week, both Democrats and Republicans alike were more than a bit shocked by the vote in Kansas on Tuesday. In that vote, Kansas voters overwhelmingly rejected a ballot initiative which would have allowed state legislatures to enact abortion restrictions. As a matter of fact, you take a look at the data, it was 58.9% against that and 41.1% for it. So let's set this up a little bit, because this can be a little confusing, especially if you're in a state that doesn't have these kinds of initiatives. The initiative was known as Value Them Both, and the amendment would have removed constitutional protections for abortion that came from a 2019 ruling by the Kansas Supreme Court. So that's what's going on. Now, when you dig into these numbers a little bit, though, Ken, I saw some things that were, you know, I think worth talking about. I'm going to point a few out. I'm sure you've got a few to point out as well. One is turnout. Turnout was high. As a matter of fact, this was the highest ever in Kansas for a midterm primary. It clocked in at 908,700 voters. The next closest would have been 2020, where it just passed the 60,000 mark. But on average, what you're talking about in Kansas going back the last decade is right around, so the average there is going to be right around 400,000 votes. So again, 400,000 is your decade average, 908,000 on this particular item with the referendum, the Value Them Both. The other thing that I noted I'd like you to think about is, so you take a look at registered Republicans and Democrats, right? Republicans make up 44% of the registered population. Just 26% of Kansas is registered Democrat, 30% unaffiliated or other. Now, this comes, again, in a state where Donald Trump, as NPR has already noted, won in 2020 by 15 points. So, on the Democratic side, and many who are sympathetic to the Democratic side, they see this potentially as a midterm silver lining. Republican operatives, on the other hand, such as John Freely, argued that although this might be a quote-unquote wake-up call for the pro-life movement, he sees this as just a need to get on the same page and step away from things like gay marriage and focus in on inflation and economics, which is where people actually vote when you have names on the ballot, as opposed to this, which he sees as being more about the referendum and some breakaways. So, Ken, that's a lot of data I'm throwing at you, a lot of things. What are your thoughts on the referendum vote in Kansas?
Yeah, well, turnout is the big story, but I think that's a good story for Democrats looking forward into November and into future fights, because to me what it means is that abortion will motivate turnout. And I think just the same way that high turnout election was good for this referendum, high turnout election is going to be good for Democrats in pretty much all the midterm congressional elections as well. Last time you and I talked about this, I said I thought abortion was the number one issue in November. And I think the Democrats have to work hard to make it the number one issue in November. And I think there's a lot of political upside from the Democratic perspective here to the Dobbs decision, even though it's going to have, I think, a horrific effect on the lives of many American women.
So one of the things I wanted to drill on that front, because I've been trying to think about that systematically, this is a little bit more of my wheelhouse, and that is, Kansas, when you look at it structurally, is a little bit unique, legally speaking, which might explain some of the political participation variable. So, for example, the protection to abortion in Kansas by the 2019 ruling in their constitution meant that they're in a very unique situation from, say, here where we are in Oklahoma, where there is no such constitutional protection. Do you think the fact that that there was an ability to strike it down on an amendment level encouraged participation, because you effectively had a form of direct democracy where you thought, okay, well, I'm voting on this issue because this is exactly the issue I'm voting on. How do you think that then translates into a number of states where those protections don't exist? And so to get that win, you'd actually have to flip state legislatures, something that's probably not as likely and maybe therefore not as likely to create as big of a turnout boost. I had been kind of working through that, modelly speaking, in my mind. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think this issue can flip too many state legislatures because of the extreme gerrymandering. It can flip some statewide races. I'm feeling quite confident that the Dems will maintain control of the U.S. Senate, where all the races are statewide races. And there's a lot of factors there, including some of the very poor candidates that the Republicans have nominated. But I do think that the abortion issue is gonna affect those elections as well. Remember that in Kansas, it wasn't a pro-choice initiative that the voters just voted on. It was an anti-choice initiative, and the voters
turned out to reject
the anti-choice initiative. So I think it is I think the sponsors of this amendment who had hoped to overturn the Kansas Supreme Court ruling guaranteeing abortion rights, they put it on a primary. They put it up for vote on a primary election day rather than on a November election day, because they thought it had a better chance if it was a low turnout election, and they hoped that it wouldn't itself spur turnout. And especially in Kansas, one of the political conditions of Kansas, you were mentioning some of its unique conditions. So many of the legislative seats there are either so gerrymandered or just in places where there aren't any Democrats anyhow, that generally there's very little reason for Democrats to turn up for primaries, because they'd be voting in primaries where there's usually not a contested seat for the Democratic nomination, because usually whoever is the nominee is going to be a sacrificial lamb anyhow in a unwinnable November election. So, Republicans have something at stake in their primaries, because their primaries are likely to choose the actual candidate who will win, whereas Democrats, have essentially nothing at stake in most Kansas primaries, because, they have no hope of seating someone who's going to win a general election. So the primaries for that reason are very skewed towards Republican voters. But nonetheless, Democrats turned out in incredible numbers, and Republicans as well, because I think about a quarter of the Republicans in Kansas also voted to keep abortion legal in Kansas. But I think three quarters of them voted against that. But Democrats turned out in incredible numbers, just for this abortion issue, even though there was no other reason for them to turn out in the primary election. So I think that does show that this is an issue that's really motivating people.
Let's get into those numbers you were talking about, because I brought some of those up. Yeah, I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is just total registered Republicans in the state. That's 44% of all registered voters in the state are Republican, and just 26, or about a quarter of registered Republicans in the state, are Democrat. And you brought up another important data point there, which is, you know, about a third-ish of the voters who showed up who were Republican rejected the ballot initiative as well. So one of the things that you know, again, I'm still trying to work through. I don't know if I'm necessarily as convinced as you are that this is going to be an inflection point for statewide races, although it could in some. I'm not opposed to that. What I think it might definitely say, and that is that there is this idea that Republicans are kind of lockstep on the issue of pro-life. And if in Kansas you can't get closer to 100% of Republicans doing that, I think it's pretty clear that is a wrong position. And I hear that both from the left and the right frequently, right? The left criticizing Republicans as kind of all being pro-life nutties, and likewise Republicans who are pro-life kind of assuming that others are all just like them as well. I think this really highlights a little bit of the diversity. Now, again, we know where I come down on this particular one, but I do think that reality is not one that both political players always recognize.
Yeah, I would say Republicans, political players used to recognize that. And I think that's why President Reagan, President George H.W. Bush, even President George W. Bush, you know, given the opportunity to do what Trump did, which was to just put enough justices on the court to overrule Roe, I think they all purposely tried not to do that because they could sense that, you know, Roe was something that Republicans wanted to be continuously and permanently running against, but never succeeding in getting overruled. And that Trump was really the first one who didn't, you know, understand the subtlety of that. And he got it overruled. And I do think that, you know, Democrats are almost entirely pro-choice. They really are lockstep on that issue. And Republicans have always had a minority segment of the Republicans who are also pro-choice, and Americans as a whole are pro-choice. And so I think it is, you know, it's going to be a wake-up call. It's going to be hard to keep those pro-choice Republicans voting Republican when abortion is actually on the ballot.
This brings me to a little bit of political science knowledge that might be worth sharing. And you were getting at it here, so this is a good juncture. One of the items in the study of Congress is there's this kind of revolutionary thought. When you think about legislative bodies, or really think about any kind of government bodies, but let's focus on the legislature here because that's what we're talking about. When you think about legislative bodies, you think, what are they supposed to be doing? Legislating, right? Of course. Cool. But is that really what they want to do? And so there's this guy named David Mayhew who actually posits this really famous theory that we still use, but it's the beginning of it, that says when you drill down to it, politicians, legislatures are not going to be as interested in legislation as you might think, because that's not where the payoff from voters is, right? Voters are not particularly willing to reward individuals for hard legislative work. They're really rewarding them, in other words, reelecting them, for these other kinds of reasons. And one of the ones I want to point out that Mayhew has here is this idea of position taking. And what Mayhew is arguing is that the position and having that position is far more important for reelection than any legislative activity that one might undertake to accomplish that end, right? Because it allows voters to signal and say, ah, this is the person that I want. And I think for a long time, the pro-life has been on that front. Even, I mean, again, I'm one who's on that particular side. But it's easy to think, okay, and then once we get it, we win, but not necessarily. And political scientists, you know, we could have told you, like, look, winning an issue doesn't necessarily get you rewarded at the ballot box in any meaningful way, especially if it takes away your ability to have this kind of position take. And I think one of the reasons you don't have the position take now is there's no easy way to signal what you are. There's a lot of confusion about what that is, because now we're arguing about, okay, well, what form ought that or ought that not to take? I always like being able to bring a little bit of political science. Is Mayhew one that you were familiar with, Ken? I mean, and that idea of position taking, is that one that you're familiar with?
I didn't know that literature. I appreciate you for bringing that up. I think it's the same thing I was saying. I just didn't know the literature about it. But
I wanted to talk about it, and you were saying, I thought, let's put the name on it, right? You know, this is what it is.
Right, because you know you have a lot more people who don't like abortion and think of themselves as pro-life until they actually see, you know, a 10-year-old girl raped by a neighbor having to go across state lines to terminate a pregnancy. And then, you know, when they see what that really looks like, you know, it's a wake-up call for some people. And so I think, you know, being able to just position on issues, you know, where there's no changes in law happening is one thing. But when changes in law are having, you know, visible and I would say very harmful effects on real human beings and people kind of see what that looks like, I think then you're you know, it has a different look than when people are just positioning earlier. And also, I think the whole concept of pro-choice Republicans, which was always a minority coalition within the Republican Party, It's possible to be that as long as you think the Supreme Court has taken the issue off the table anyhow. So someone who agrees with Republicans on taxes or trade or defense or immigration doesn't agree with them on abortion might not have a lot of problem voting Republican, because it doesn't matter what the legislature thinks about abortion because the Supreme Court has taken it off the table. But now that the Supreme Court's put it back on the table, it may, you know, I think this Kansas turnout number really shows that it's a extremely important issue to quite a lot of people, including some pro-choice Republicans.
Now, there was something else that you had said earlier, and I wasn't ready to explore it quite yet, and I thought we might finish up talking about it a little bit because it'll segue nicely into our next topic. That is, you said that you think the Democrats are going to retain control of the Senate. I'd like you to talk into that a little bit more. And do you think that's primarily due to the abortion issue? And you had also mentioned, to be fair, you'd also mentioned the issue of some historically potentially weak Republican candidates. So talk into both of those for just a moment.
Yeah, I think Pennsylvania, those two issues make it certain to flip. Right. So I can't exactly assign, you know, how much of it is about abortion and how much of it is about, the weakness of the Dr. Oz. But I think when you add the two together, there's no doubt that Pennsylvania is going to flip. I think I'd put that in the 99% category. Occupied. Yeah. Yeah. The seat that's currently occupied by Toomey, who's a retiring Republican, will soon be occupied by Fetterman. So that gives the Dems a pickup already. I think the Dems have a very decent chance at a pickup in Wisconsin for similar reasons. Now, Ron Johnson is an incumbent running for re-election, but I think he's a weak candidate. And I think Wisconsin's a pro-choice state where Democrats have been able to win statewide elections. It's a severely gerrymandered state, and it's hard for Dems to get any traction in the state legislature or in the congressional delegation there because of the gerrymandering. But I think Wisconsin's another likely Dem pickup, and I do think the Dems will hold on in Georgia with Warnock against Herschel Walker, who's another weak candidate. Now there, I would say I'd put probably more of that to the strength of Warnock and the weakness of Herschel Walker as candidates, rather than to the abortion issue, which I think is more mixed in Georgia than in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin. But, you know, I that's sort of what I'm looking at here. I don't see how all three of those go bad, or even two out of three of those go bad from a Democratic perspective.
Well, one of the things that I'm wondering there, you know, Oz, I think, is going to be a phenomenal case example. I often think that the popularity, name recognition element of elections is underappreciated. It's one of the reasons early on I had more rapidly, despite despising him, thought that Trump had abilities to move forward. I don't think it's – I think one of the problems when you're trying to analyze races is assume a lot of it has to do with strong or weak candidates in the sense of they have particular kinds of issues or structural. Now, if you're talking about the structural side of it, right, where the race is going to lean, I mean, having a known name is always preferable to a non-known name in these races. So I honestly think that weirdly, even though he might on paper in some ways be a weaker candidate, gives an advantage in a tight election to Oz. When you just look at the data of what's one of the reasons why incumbents will win over and over again, in part has to do when you start drilling down into the study of legislative names. Those names that are around more often seem to win more often. And in our universe, I mean, again, take a look in, it's a different kind of race. We'll talk about it more here in a minute. But take a look at Carrie Lake in Arizona in the gubernatorial race, who this morning finally just picked off her primary opponent, despite having mentioned that earlier in the week. I'm just curious, talking to that for a minute, then we'll move into our next story, because we're talking about all the primaries anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Carrie Lake's going to benefit from having been a popular TV news anchor for a long time in Arizona. That'll be a tight race. But, in Pennsylvania, Dr. Oz is a TV doctor with name recognition. But, Fetterman also, he's been the lieutenant governor. He's 6'7" and has a very unusual kind of look that people remember. I think in Pennsylvania, both candidates have a lot of name and face recognition.
Okay, so like you were saying, well, he's got equal name recognition because he's the lieutenant governor. I would be willing to bet that you can't even find a double-digit number of individuals in anybody's state who can name their lieutenant governor, even among, even to make it a finer point, even if you put it just among, just polling registered voters.
Well, in most states, I would agree with that. But I think Fetterman, for other reasons, which I also mentioned, his being 6'7", his being very unusual looking, and him having an unusually high profile. I knew who Fetterman was, for a long time before he entered the Senate race. And I don't even live in Pennsylvania, and I can't always name my own lieutenant governor. But I think okay, Fetterman is an unusually high profile person, and I think Oz is a laughable person. Now I have my perspective on that, which is a partisan perspective, I get, but I just think he has the kind of name recognition that would make people inclined to not take him seriously. And he's also being trolled a hell of a lot for living in New Jersey, which he does, and not even living in Pennsylvania. And and I think, that's one of the things. People who know who Dr. Oz is also know that he lives in New Jersey. And I think that the name recognition comes with the negatives that go along with people knowing about him as well.
Well, before we take before we kind of switch topics here, I will just say, who picks New Jersey over any other state?
How do you mean?
I was just making a joke. Like, in other words, like, who wants to live in New Jersey?
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody say, like, Jersey, that's where I want to be, right? Anyway.
Well, Bruce Springsteen.
That was a terrible joke. Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, true.
Bruce Springsteen picks New Jersey over any other state.
True story. True story. Well, why don't we get into talking a little bit more about these primaries in general? So one of the things that we're talking about Oz already. I brought up Carrie Lake in Arizona. One of the big questions is, it appears that Trump wins a lot of ways in this past week, but that might mean the party is in a worse potential position on that front. I mean, as a matter of fact, so for example, haven't mentioned this yet, but right, Rusty Bowers, after defying Donald Trump and testifying before the January 6th committee, he loses his state Senate bid. His quote, of course, what I'd do it again in a heartbeat. I'd do it 50 times in a row, end quote. But that was not the winning position tonight, despite individuals like myself who were hoping we'd see a little bit on that front. The outvoting the fraud view, which is the view of Carrie Lake and others, seemed to win. Man, as a matter of fact, take a look, even, Pence's candidates performed pretty horribly, including Taylor Robinson. you were already kind of getting in at this. Is that part of why you're making the prediction you are at the Senate? You see that these kinds of more Trumpian candidates are kind of doomed to failure?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that they're doomed, but I think they're generally weaker candidates in competitive election. Not all these elections are going to be competitive. So, you know, in some of the elections, either in gerrymandered House districts or in states with strong partisan leaning one way or the other in statewide elections, you know, I think party nomination is going to be more important than quality of candidate. But in some of the competitive elections, and there will be some, I think quality of candidate will matter, and that the Trumpier ones are generally lower quality. In fact, I think there were even news stories, which I really question. You know, there was a spate of news stories in the last week or so saying that Democratic candidates and PACs were actually spending money to support the Trumpiest candidates because they'd rather run against those candidates than the more mainstream candidates. And I think that that kind of news reporting came up particularly in connection with the incumbent House member Peter Meyer in Michigan, who's, you know, one of the public who voted to impeach Trump. And he was just defeated in his primary election by a Trump-endorsed candidate. And there was some reporting suggesting that Democrats had been spending money to help get the Trump-endorsed candidate in. I don't think those stories are actually true. And when you read those stories, you know, I think there's a lot of spin in the way they're talking about what the Democrats were doing. There's no Democratic money that was spent other than in attack ads against the Trump endorsed candidates. But some of the reporting is saying, well, by running these attack ads against the Trump endorsed candidates, they're building up the Trump endorsed candidates. And I don't think that's accurate, but I think the idea that narrative is out there is very much consistent with the idea that you were just saying, which is that Dems would prefer to run against Trumpier candidates.
Well, let me bring some data to play here, as I want to drill into this a little bit more, because one of the things that I have always thought about carefully has been, especially in the post-Trump age, is that narrative about Trump and Trumpian candidates versus some of the data on the ground. So I was curious, took a look. If you take a look right now at Joe Biden's polling numbers, right, he's got a 55.7% disapproval rate and approximately a 39.2% approval rate. That puts him well below Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump, as of our last polls, although still pretty unfavorable, beats him by just a little bit inside the margin of error at 53.4 and 42 on the nose. Precisely. And I think sometimes that those, and then maybe this is my presidential scholar coming out of me, I think presidential approval rates often give us a better potential picture of that large takeaway when you're attaching it to a candidate. And so when I see a lot of the, hey, wait a second, I think these Trumpian candidates are going to do more poorly, they're always doing poorly relative to some particular environment. And in this case, we're talking about, for better or for worse, the Biden presidency environment. And I'm wondering, what do you think about the fact that we still, you know, again, President Biden is massively unpopular. How does that come in, especially given that although we might personally not like Trump, is polling better than him? What do you think about that?
Yeah, so there are some polls that people are already doing about a hypothetical 2024 rematch election. You know, who would you vote for, Trump versus Biden? And those are pretty even right now. Those polls are not showing one or the other winning right now, and I guess they're both fairly unpopular. I think the Biden's present unpopularity, which probably won't turn around that much by November, but I hope it will. You know, there is just, a number of, you know, great successes in the last week's news, ranging from, you know, getting the new climate bill through, which they're calling the anti-inflation bill, but it's going to be a major legislative accomplishment, and getting the Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda leader, killed, and expanding NATO. You know, there's a lot of things that Biden's doing right now, which by ordinary standards should be increasing his approval ratings. But we're in a kind of media environment where You know, it's, you know, it is difficult to do that. But I think I do think that the 2022 midterm, while being an uphill battle for Dems because of that, ultimately there's only a few battleground states with competitive elections. And I think for the reasons that we were talking about, the quality of the candidates and the abortion issue, I'm feeling pretty optimistic. And I think polls in those states are starting to turn more favorable for Dems than they were even a couple weeks ago.
Well, Ken, what I think we might want to do here is a break and then come back, because we're starting to kind of talk about some of the legislative achievements potentially coming out, and that obviously hinges on the Senate. And the next big issue that we want to take on is this past week's bipartisan attempt to codify Roe, among others. So we're going to just take a brief pause. We'll be right back. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the attempt to codify Roe. Okay, so the next topic we want to get to is this kind of bipartisan U.S. senators attempting to codify Roe. On Monday, a group of Republicans and Democrats released legislation to codify Roe v. Wade. Now, the list isn't shocking, especially, they're neither on the Republican or the Democratic side. You got Susan Collins, you got Tim Kaine, you've got Lisa Murkowski, you've got Sinema. We all know that this isn't going to pass, but it might get a floor vote. And I think the hope for some is that, especially in light of what we've been talking about in Kansas, this might make people take positions and therefore change that midterm layout that we were talking about earlier. Now, so far, at least as of Friday, Schumer hasn't said that he's going to push it forward for a floor vote, but I feel confident that if I was he, I would want to do that. What do you think about the fact that we have this bipartisan group did it right at this this time? Republicans obviously have to be feeling particularly upset with a couple of these names because it potentially puts them in a difficult position in light of what we saw in Kansas. What do you think about this movement, and how does it maybe tie in to some of those larger achievements that you were talking about at the end of the last story, Ken?
Yeah, I think he will bring it forward. I think the delay right now is because of the they haven't voted yet on the I would call it the climate bill, but the bill that Manchin's calling the anti-inflation bill. I think that that's a very high priority thing that they're going to move through maybe tomorrow, maybe Sunday or Monday. I think right now when Schumer says, doesn't say he's bringing it to the floor, it's only because he doesn't want to throw a monkey wrench in that climate bill's progress to the floor. But I think as soon as the climate bill is voted, the abortion bill will come to the floor. I don't think there's going to be the 60 votes to pass it, but it is at this point more about positioning. And I hope that they'll follow it up with contraception bills and with same-sex marriage bills. And with, I think there should be votes every day on these kind of bills. All the implications of the Dobbs decision, if I was Schumer, I wouldn't let a day go by in August, September, October where there wasn't a vote on some bill like that.
Well, to kind of put that timeline into perspective, late last night, of course, Kristen Sinema offered the support that was going to be needed for that inflation or the move forward bill, or excuse me, the scaled back Build Back Better bill. So it looks like it's going to have the 50 votes. And again, as a reminder, it can move forward by 50 votes because the parliamentarian has argued that it can move forward through that reconciliation process. So it sounds like what you're saying is, hey, we don't want to scare Sinema or other individuals, but of course. But she's one of the ones in the bipartisan group, so it seems unlikely she would necessarily be one who would be potentially skittish. What other kinds of things might you bring forward? You said, look, you're not going to let a day go by where you're not going to take some of these floor bills. What else would you bring forward?
Well, contraception, same-sex marriage, for sure. I would try to, some of these bills, if you look at all the different types of unenumerated liberties that the U.S. Supreme Court had been protecting prior to Dobbs, some of them I think even Republicans would vote in favor of. So you could have something like an extended family's right to cohabitate bill, or a parental rights bill, or things like that. So there's some of those kinds of unenumerated rights that the court has protected. But I think with abortion in particular, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of abortion bills that can be brought forward. So not only could Roe be brought forward, you know, the bill to just reinstate the Roe regime, but the Roe regime itself had a lot of individual rules that were part of it. So, for instance, you could have a particular bill on spousal notification that women should not have to notify their husbands in order to get an abortion. And, you know, that's one of the rules that was protected under Roe and again under Casey that went away under Dobbs. You know, bring that back as a freestanding bill and have a vote on that. Have a vote on a bill to give the opportunity for girls under 18 to get a judicial bypass, which would, where a judge could allow them to get an abortion without notifying their parents. You know, all these kind of subsidiary abortion bills, which Roe and Casey had developed a whole doctrine, but I would break out those doctrinal rules one at a time and just keep voting them and just have as many votes as possible. You know, again, not with the thought that it's going to any of them are going to get 60 votes, but just with the thought that going into November, the more votes like that, the better.
So, in effect, just breaking off the pieces of the judicial doctrine that has, I think, and that's, you were talking about that. That's something that kind of worth pointing out. We oftentimes talk about Roe as being this singular thing, but in all honesty, and this is not just a reproductive or an abortion issue, right? There are really no legislative doctrines that, you know, there's just one case, right, that deals with it. It is a body of common law. It's a body of judicial precedent that builds on itself to deal with all these kinds of specific issues that are coming up. I mean, matter of fact, I mean, as an undergraduate, you take a con law class, which is nothing like what you're going to be teaching, and that's what you're doing is you're trying to tracing some of these judicial precedents as they cluster together into a nucleus of understanding. So you'd say, hey, look, break each of these little bits of the cluster off, put them up for a vote so they have to just take these votes over and over and over again.
Yeah, I might even go a step farther too. And like, so for instance, the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution has had this strange history where by now 38 states have in fact ratified it, which is the number that it takes to do a constitutional amendment, but they, you know, that not within the relevant time frames. So we don't have the Equal Rights Amendment. But I think just putting the language of the Equal Rights Amendment up for a congressional vote to make it an equal rights statute, which would just say equality under law shall not be denied on account of sex. You know, have a roll call vote on that. I'll bet the Republicans would filibuster that one too, and I think that would be another, you know, very politically beneficial thing for the Dems to take into the November elections.
Now, this brings us to kind of a procedural and a more technical issue, but maybe something for us to then talk to listeners about. That's what you're listening to the Politics Guys for. All of these kinds of things, right? So again, to go back, the reason that Sinema's 50th vote is so crucial is because the parliamentarian has ruled that because it's reconciliation, you don't have to meet the ability to end debate or the cloture rule in the Senate. You don't need 60 votes proceed on a particular issue. And you're right, it's unlikely that you're going to get any of these because any one particular senator can change the number of individuals who you need to pass a particular bill from 50 to 60. And as the two of us, we've talked about it on the show, the number of bills that now have to reach that threshold have grown over time. So I guess we've talked about that portion. As we talk about this, here's where maybe some of the rubber and the procedural understanding, how the sausage gets made, meets the road. How many individuals do you think, if these things get filibustered, will actually impact anybody as they're making electoral choices? It's a difficult process to understand, and you wouldn't necessarily have a vote on those bills. You'd be having a vote on whether or not to have a vote on those bills, which again, that seems like a bunch of meaninglessness, but it is in fact what's going on, and it does change to some extent the perception on those kinds of votes. What do you think about that for those kinds of plays? Thoughts on that front?
Well, I think the second part of what you said, the distinction between a vote on a bill or a vote on whether to have a vote on a bill, I think that's too subtle for voters to understand. So I think it will be perfectly possible politically. You know, if you get a 55-45 vote on whether to have a vote on a Roe bill, and the 45 who vote not to have the vote on the Roe bill have therefore filibustered the Roe bill, I think the public will be able to understand that as being identical to they voted against the Roe bill. I don't think that the subtleties are going to, you know, I think it'll be harder for them to understand the subtleties than to understand the substance, which is that the people who filibuster a bill are actually voting against the bill and blocking it. So I think they'll get that. I think that, you know, it's going to help the Dems to nationalize this election and nationalize these issues. You know, these are issues that in the country as a whole, the public opinion is squarely on the side of the issues that the Democrats are on, and public opinion is squarely against the issues that the sides of the issues the Republicans are on. Now, there may be a few states where that's not true, but there's many, many more states today, including states that vote Republican, who agree with the Democratic side of the abortion issue, the contraception issue, the gay rights and same-sex marriage issue, the equality under law issue. And so I think it can benefit. I get what you're saying, that the you have to take that down to the state level or to the district level and ask, you know, in each individual race, you know, but is that really going to make a difference in this race? Of course, that's of course the right way to think about it. But what I'm just saying is that there are some races where it will have to make a difference if it makes a difference in the country as a whole.
Yeah, and again, to put that argument in context, which what you're effectively saying is, look, I recognize that it's a more, midterms under these environments are more difficult for the Democratic Party, but these are the kinds of variables that will tip the scale slightly in the other direction. It's going to put it, or maybe not slightly. I just mean it's going to be putting its finger on the other side of that scale to kind of counterbalance some of those structural negatives the Democrats are having there.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say. So thank you.
Okay. So why don't we move forward? I mean, we're talking about the Senate. Let's move forward and talk about the Senate just a little bit more. You know, this past week on Wednesday, in a 95-1 vote, U.S. senators approved membership for Finland and Sweden. Several senators voted president. The singular vote against came from Josh Hawley, who argued that we needed to be fighting China, not Russia, and we're spending too much time effectively thinking about our Russian alliance. He said, we can do more in Europe, devote more resources, more firepower, or do what we need to do to deter Asia and China. We cannot do both, end quote, Hawley said. He called his approach classic nationalist, but obviously none really of his none of his colleagues agreed with that outcome. Ken, before I have you say anything, I'm going to pause for a minute. All of a sudden, your microphone is picking up enough background static, and I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as 95 out of 96 senators who voted thought, Hawley is just wrong about this. The United States, besides being, you know, incredibly more militarily powerful than any country on Earth, it's been our policy since the end of World War II to participate in both NATO and SEATO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. And we can certainly be strong enough to protect Europe and protect Asia. And in fact, it was, you know, one of the strategies for protecting Asia from China was the President Obama's attempt to get us into the Pacific Trade Treaty to draw us closer to the other Asian countries as a bulwark against China. And I believe Hawley voted against that. And so I don't know how sincere he even is about the idea that we need to be doing more to protect Asia against China.
Yeah, I mean, Trump, you know, that was right at the end of the Obama presidency. Trump ends up torpedoing that deal as well. You know, you don't even end up getting all of the votes on it because Trump pulls back, which I saw as being one of the first and one of the major economic blunders of the early Trump presidency, was not following through with deeper integrative ties to Asia that Obama had kind of left on his doorstep to run with. I mean, that would, I think, would have been an easy, and again, a classic Republican position to create better trading conditions with our Asian partners, and thereby, again, this coming from, I recognize it, a libertarian perspective, those kinds of agreements decrease the likelihood for war.
Yeah, well, that to me, that's the bigger part of it. Like, I'd say, actually, from my perspective, PTT, if you think of it from an economic perspective, I don't know that I think it was good for American workers, but I would support it anyhow, really for the political reasons more than the economic reasons. I think it was important for the U.S. to develop much closer ties. Closer economic ties lead to closer political ties, closer friendship with all the Asian countries that surround China as a way of kind of isolating China. And really, when we didn't do PTT, that forced those countries to become more involved with China, which gives China more power over them. So it's, I really see that as primarily the benefit of it as having primarily been political. And I think for, the senators, which I'm sure included Hawley, who were criticizing the PTT, it seems a little disingenuous for him now to be saying, well, it's more important for us to protect our friends in, I don't know if he named the countries, but like South Korea or Taiwan or Japan, against China. We had a chance to develop even more of a presence in those countries.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the last and the next story that we're going to take on, which is Pelosi's Taiwan trip. But it is strange to me in some ways, although I suppose it shouldn't be. It is always strange to live through party deposition taking, right? So, one of the things that you get, once you have Republicans and Democrats being established institutionally in the United States as the two major parties, because of our electoral rules, we always have two major parties and always have. But we, the parties themselves had shifted over time. What happens once those two parties become entrenched in the Reconstruction era is effectively why those two institutional groups continue. It doesn't mean their actual ideological or their primary bases remain the same, right? So, for example, Republicans were traditionally the city and the Northeastern Party, and this switches kind of with the Southern strategy of Nixon. And I really do feel, and I'm curious about this, Kim, but when I take a look at like Hawley's comments and I take a look at the post-Trump Republican Party, I think one of the things we're going to look back on is say, well, this is the area of a party reorienting, and that the political parties, as we think of them, they'll still be Republicans and Democrats, but what they are will be different after this inflection point. What do you think about that? It's one of the things I just can't help but seeing, especially in the conflict with the Ukraine against Russia and the sides that have been taken there. And then again, as we've seen now, and again, we'll move in a little bit more with the Pelosi trip, kind of like, why are you being belligerent to China? I see some of that emerging, especially as it relates to international issues. Thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, the vote, on Sweden and Finland entering NATO was 95-1. So that, that is pretty bipartisan. And I think, when Obama was trying to negotiate the PTT, the support and opposition actually was both more bipartisan than usual, right? So there were the America Firsters who were opposing the PTT, but there were also like the Bernie Sanders wing of the Dems who were also opposing the PTT. So I think on these issues, I don't know that everything's broken down along the usual partisan lines. I think when Nixon first went to China in the 70s, one of the reasons he was able to do it was actually because he wouldn't be accused of being pro-communist, right? That if a Democratic president had tried to go normalize relations with China, they would have been accused of being soft on communism or pro-communist or something like that. And so by the time Nixon went, there was a very bipartisan support for normalizing relations with China. So I don't know that these things always follow partisan lines. I do think that the kind of nativism, which in some forms I would call white nationalism, which is a force within the Trump wing of the Republican Party, I hope that's not a mainstream thinking within the Republican Party. I mean, I think, you know, if you listen to like a Hawley talking about, you know, why we should not worry about Europe, but you know, fight China. I mean, there's kind of an element of, you know, because Europe's white and China's not. And I, you know, that I think is a little bit, you know, deplorable, but it is, it's, I don't think it's where most Republicans are. I think it is where some Trump Republicans are. But I don't know if I'm fully addressing your question or not, or if I've kind of missed the import of it.
I think you're there a little bit. I guess on some of these issues, and you're right. I mean, maybe part of my problem is that I'm missing the overarching forest of the 95-1 vote to the tree. And maybe I'm just a little surprised that we have one senator who moved in a direction that I find kind of bizarre from his own point. But that, yeah, I'm going to say in this case, Ken, that you've actually just kind of convinced me that I'm wrong on that front.
Okay. Well, thank you. I wasn't sure. Yeah, I wasn't sure quite if I even had addressed it. So that's good.
Yeah. Good job. Well, I do. I want to leave some space so we can talk about our last big issue, because I think it's worth some talk. And that was, you know, we've had the lead up this way to Pelosi's Taiwan trip. A lot of question: will she? Won't she? Should she? Shouldn't she? But she ends up doing it, and she is in Taiwan. Gets out in response. China takes some drastically belligerent tactics. It will surround Taiwan, the small country. It will launch rocket and ballistic missiles. As a matter of fact, we have the reports confirmed as of Friday that they launched missiles over, Taiwan. And likewise, it appears at this juncture that this includes things getting into the space of South Korea. And this doesn't appear to be over yet. They're going to continue to do this for a number of days. Pelosi, for her part, argues, look, we can't make our decisions about who we're going to stand up to the person who says, well, I'm going to shoot the gun. But that doesn't always seem to be what everybody like. What do you think about this? It's a complicated one. I'll just start off by saying I liked Pelosi's trip. I'm not always a big Nancy Pelosi supporter. I mean, rarely, I guess. But I'm not a big fan of the idea that we shouldn't do things because somebody with a big gun says we ought not to do them, because that seems to me to be kind of be the opposite of maybe what you want to do. Now, I don't want anybody to get killed necessarily, but you know, if you say, look, if we're going to stand up for Taiwan, if that really is going to be our position, it seems hard to take it if they simultaneously say, but we're not ever going to send anybody there to, you know, talk or have a negotiation because, well, China doesn't want us to. But maybe you have a different perspective. What did you think about it, Ken?
No, I have the same perspective as you. I'm glad she went. I think it was absolutely the right thing to do. I would put this in the perspective also of think about China's conduct in the recent and more distant past, in Hong Kong more recently, and in Tibet a little longer ago. You know that even in Uyghur province, which is in China, but you know, which has non-ethnic Chinese living in it, the Chinese government has, you know, increasingly been ratcheting up a policy of essentially, you know, taking over other territories that they have some kind of claim to, and then moving quickly to end freedom and establish totalitarianism in those places. And you know, it happened, you know, first I think in Tibet, and then, you know, more recently the China violated the Hong Kong Treaty, which guaranteed political freedom in China, in Hong Kong, for 99 years. We're nowhere near that 99 years yet, and they've basically ended it already. They've always had a rhetorical commitment to the idea that they're going to take back Taiwan one day. And we've always had a rhetorical commitment to the idea that we will protect the independence and freedom of Taiwan, you know, even within a system where we will ultimately recognize that it has some affiliation with China. And China, I think, has been starting to make moves to move on Taiwan the same way it recently moved on Hong Kong. And I think if we have the policy that will protect the I think it's about 3.5 million people who live on Taiwan, or I could be off on that number. But there's people who live there who have a freedom and democracy and who are friendly to the United States. And, you know, I think it's right to protect them. And so I think it's right for the U.S. to keep acting the way we've always acted. And, you know, many Congress members have gone to visit Taiwan. You know, I think the last time a congressional leader went was Newt Gingrich about 25 years ago. But, you know, even as recently as earlier this year, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators was over in Taiwan. And it's not an unusual thing. It's a normal thing for members of U.S. Congress or U.S. government. I think when during the Trump administration's the Health and Human Services Secretary, Alex Azar, went over there. It's kind of a normal thing for U.S. government officials to go there. And if we suddenly say, well, now China says they're going to make trouble if we go, so we better not go, like that's the first step towards basically, you know, ceding Taiwan to the same kind of fate that Hong Kong's in the middle of suffering right now. The only thing I would add, which I don't know, I haven't watched media coverage of this, and this is my own speculation, is the way it was reported in the media, Biden sort of publicly called on Pelosi not to go, and she went anyhow. And he said, well, I can't tell her what to do. She's Speaker of the House. I don't really believe that Biden, I think privately he told her it's fine if she goes. I really can't believe that, you know, there was a bona fide conflict between Biden and Pelosi about whether it was a good idea to go. I think Biden probably thought that the best thing to do was for her to go, but for him to kind of maintain some plausible deniability. And I do think that was orchestrated and coordinated, not an actual, I don't think she actually disregarded his actual intent.
You know, can I ask a question on this front? I'm not the belligerent Republican, right? I mean, so that's never been my position. But I too had looked at that, and like you, I think it's probably a strategy, but it felt like a terrible one. Because the narrative of the Biden presidency is that he kind of lacks control and that he doesn't have especially international resolve. And it felt to me like by taking that path, I don't know precisely what he gains. I don't think that China behaves any differently whether he makes that comment or not. I mean, especially seeing we've seen it happen. But it seems like he ends up ceding a lot of international moral authority, which is really crucial for the presidency. And while, of course, that helps Pelosi in some ways, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with that side of it, it really does seem to put him in a weakened position. It seemed like a terrible strategic play. So I agree with you on the front of I think that was, you know, a calculated move, but it seems like a really terrible calculated move. What would you say to that?
I don't agree with that. I mean, it's a difficult situation to think of what's the right move. But remember, no U.S. president has gone to Taiwan, right? So there's been this little bit of, you know, the U.S. policy is kind of very subtle because it at the same time that we've always committed to protecting freedom and democracy in Taiwan, we've also always committed to the one China policy where we recognize that ultimate sovereignty over Taiwan resides in the People's Republic of China, that it's not an independent country. And so I think for a president, it would be more provocative for the president to seem to be involved in an unprecedented way in sanctioning some new way of disrespecting the one China policy, whereas since Congress members and congressional leaders have traditionally gone there, you know, the idea is that really what we're doing is maintaining the status quo. The status quo is that Congress members go there and presidents don't. And so what we're trying to message out here internationally is we're accepting no changes in the status quo. We're not escalating hostilities, but we're not accepting a reduced role. And so because of that context, I think that he basically played it right, that if he would have you know, made more forceful statements in support of the idea that he wants her to go there, I think that actually would have been an escalation, because I don't think U.S. presidents have done that before. Whereas, you know, I think for Congress members to just go there, that's more aligned with what has been done before.
Well, Ken, that's a fascinating perspective, but we're going to have to leave it there, and that's going to be it for this week's show because we've kind of run out of time. So I always want to say, if you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without you, there's no way this podcast is going to keep on going. You get all kind of fun, good stuff, though, if you become a supporter, like an ad-free version of everything we put out, in addition to our supporter-exclusive midweek show. That's where we're going to start breaking away from the news cycle, and we're going to start talking about things in a broader context. We're going to start having some mini-series. We're going to do some, I think, some really fun stuff. I've been excited and thinking about this for a long time, and so I'm really hopeful that you will be excited too and want to carry on with me and Ken in a way where we're not just discussing those news items, but getting a little bit more deeply into kind of ideas and thoughts about politics. So if you want to become a supporter, if you want to kind of see what the rest of it is, or if you just want to get rid of the ads in this show, you can do that by going to patreon.com/politicsguys. Or if you'd like, you can also support us on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. Additionally, you can support the show through PayPal. All of our support links are in the show notes, as well as by heading to politicsguys.com/support. So right there in the link. Now, by becoming a supporter, one of the other really fun things you get to become a part of is our very active Politics Guys Discord group. There's even Politics Guys gear and other kinds of benefits at different levels. Again, to see all of that, head to the support links or head over to politicsguys.com/support. Now, if you'd like to get our midweek show, but you're just not in a position to financially do it, I mean, I get that, right? I've got three kiddos and we're on a single salary. It can be tough sometimes. That's not a problem. It's one of the things I like about us. All you got to do if you want to do that, if you're in that kind of position, is just email Mike at mike@politicsguys.com and he'll set you up. Whether you're a supporter or not, we would really appreciate it if you would subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever podcast app you use. Of course, Apple is the best, but all of them count. I'm teasing. So please share those episodes on social media and connect with us there as well. If you've got a question, comment, correction, gripe, manifesto, or just something you want to share with all of us, we really do, in fact, read it by sending it to mail@politicsguys.com. If you're a supporter, though, don't forget to head to Discord. We'll get there as well. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you'll find all those links in the show notes. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new episode next week, and I hope you'll join us then.